You know, I think that we have to be worried about every single last one of those folks in each group and demographic. And I will tell you, you know, there's a famous speech that Mario Cuomo gave in 1984 at the Democratic National Convention, where he says, for the teacher in Little Rock, Arkansas, who makes very little money, her concerns are our concerns. For the labor movement worker in San Francisco, his concerns are our concerns. For the mining person in West Virginia, same thing. And that's what I think about. It's not just about Stanford. It's the concerns of every person in our state, no matter what they believe, no matter what party affiliation they may hold, no matter their race or gender. I seriously am concerned for all of them.
We'll discuss race and how it plays a factor, and how we didn't even talk about this topic because we were afraid.
A Black Executive Perspective.
BEP is on fire. Our audience is growing fast and the impact is real. Now is the time for your brand to grow with us and reach a highly engaged, influential community with real spending power. Don't miss this moment. Email us today at media@tonytidbit.com. Let's make it happen and put you and your brand in front of the people that matter. We are coming to you live from our BEP studio for another thought-provoking episode of a Black Executive Perspective podcast, a safe space where we discuss all matters regarding race, culture, and those uncomfortable topics people tend to avoid. I'm your host, Tony Tidbit. So before we get started on this fantastic episode, I want to make sure that you guys check out our partners at Code M Magazine, whose mission is to save the Black family by first saving the Black man. So check them out at codemmagazine.com. That is codemmagazine.com. So today we're sitting down with State Representative Corey Parris, a rising leader in public service and community activism. From Champion Connecticut Student Loan Reimbursement Program to fighting for affordable housing and child care reform, Cody embodies what it means to turn passion into policy. In this candid conversation, we're going to explore the challenges of leadership at a young age, the impact of student debt relief, the fight for working families, and the often contentious battle of housing rights. But before we get into that, let me tell you a little bit about my boy, Corey. Corey Parris has dedicated his life to public service and community activism, grounded in the belief that eradicating inequality requires cooperation, courage, and transformative ideas. Currently serving as the Chief Impact Officer at Person to Person, he helps over 28,000 residents achieve stability through food, housing, and economic opportunity. Corey previously drove record fundraising as Chief Development Officer at Children's Learning Center here in Fairfield County. A seasoned political leader, he has served as Connecticut's Young Democrats president, vice chair of the Appropriations Committee, house chair of the Committee on Children, and is a founding force behind Connecticut's Student Loan Reimbursement Program. Beyond politics, Corey lends his expertise to numerous boards, including the Stanford Partnership, Ferguson Library, and the Association of Fundraising Professionals. Born in Little Rock, Arkansas, and raised in Kansas City, which we're going to dive into, he is a proud graduate of Western Connecticut State University with a degree in political science. His mantra, which I love, service plus cooperation equals transformation. State Representative Corey Parris, welcome to a Black Executive Perspective podcast, my brother.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate you having me.
Buddy, we appreciate you being here. And here's the thing, man. You know, and we're going to dive into this. Let me just real off the bat, how old are you?
You know, it's funny that you asked that. I had to do the math not too long ago to say, am I really that age? So I just turned 34 on August 3rd, on the 3rd of this month. And so I was first elected at 29. It's hard to believe now that it's been almost 5 years in. I feel more like I'm 54 because the work just goes so quickly. And I've gotten grayer certainly since that time, but I'm a young 34-year-old.
Buddy, so think about that. We just went through your bio and all the things that you have accomplished. Yeah. Number one, happy belated birthday. Thank you. Number two, for somebody who's just turned 34 and all the things that you are doing, my brother, and to be fair, and let's be fair too, 34 is not old, but you look like you're 26.
I appreciate that. I'll
all right, 25. Okay, so it's fantastic. So just going back to, we are excited and really blessed that you, you know, and obviously you have a busy schedule, that you are able to carve out some time to come on a Black Executive Perspective podcast to talk about a bunch of important things that our audience really cares about, and more importantly, a broader audience in terms of the things that you are doing to help affect lives, change people's outcomes. So I'm really looking forward to diving into that. But before we get into it, you know, tell us a little bit about where you currently reside and a little bit about your family.
Well, I currently reside in the great city of Stamford, and I represent their 145th district, which has had many legislative powerhouses before me who have represented that great district in the Connecticut House of Representatives, including my immediate predecessor, Senator Pat Billy Miller, and Representative the late Crystal Truglia, and our honorable senior senator from the state of Connecticut, Dick Blumenthal. They were all state representatives in that district, so it encompasses the west side and water side of Stamford. It's a first exit right outside of Greenwich. I feel like that's when you actually kind of start to feel a little bit more your income levels when you come into Stamford. But I've been a proud Stamford resident for some time, fell in love with the city first time I ever visited some 15 years ago. But I was born in Arkansas, as you had alluded to, and raised in Kansas City, and my family is still in both areas, in both places. Our family has a deep history in Kansas in terms of our migration from the South to, you know, earning and owning our first piece of land, which our family farm sits on to this day and has been in our family for generations. So learning a lot about just the pride behind our history there. And in addition to that, have been a proud, you know, adopted son of this great state, and for which I give my life to service, in service to the state. So, you know, really humble upbringing, a pretty easy, normal existence for the most part. Had lots of cousins around, and we went to church and all went to school together, and was always at my great grandparents' homes. On the weekends, and it was just really fun. We're rooted in deeply rooted in our faith and our focus on family. And then, you know, I actually had lived in Las Vegas for a little bit of time due to just a transition within the family unit, and went back to Kansas City after finishing high school. So it's been a fun experience living in various different places, but I will tell you that Connecticut always feels more, I've lived in Connecticut longer than any other place in my life. That feels more like home to me than anywhere else.
So number one, thanks for that. Number two, my friend, so married, kids, anything like that currently?
Not married. I will be married in 24 days. From today, we have no children, but I know that's high on the boss. I call my fiance the boss because she runs everything. She's the last.
Yeah, well, you learn. Yeah, you learn.
I learned that very early on.
Right.
Marrying a woman that is very similar to that of my grandmother's, very strong-willed, very determined, very decisive, and above all else, has the tongue as sharp as a silver bullet. And so I know when to move and when to tread lightly. And so we are definitely looking forward to having children. And both of us in our work, we want to make sure that we're providing and building a world that's more inclusive and more tolerant of what we hope to raise our kids in at some point. And that's, I think, a shared vision that obviously drew us to one another.
That, well, number one, buddy, congratulations. 24 days. Seems like you hit the lotto. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if she may feel that way. All right. But
she better. I'll tell you that. She better. No, I know that people often say that the pen should always, you know, me in this point in time, I should be the one saying that I hit the lotto. And I know I did, but she should also recognize that she's hit the lotto too. I'll tell you that.
Well, I would think she does because she said yes. Okay. Now you got
actually,
24.
Tony, she never said yes.
She never said yes. So what is this, bro? Was she just winked the eye? You know, tell me.
Stone cold, shocked, shocked. She did not. That's the only time I've never seen her, speak or be able to utter words. And so she was in a state of shock. She never said yes. She just put the ring on and started planning a wedding. And so for me, I'm hoping that when we're actually at the altar with one another, she may say yes twice. Once for the engagement, the other time for the actual marriage.
Well, look, buddy, I've been in sales for a long period of time. Okay. And typically, you know, I always try to get a yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because at some point, if something goes south, they can easily say, I didn't say I wanted to do this. All right.
If she were under duress, I would say mission accomplished.
Yeah.
It's time to rethink your protein. Agrilab's protein bars are crafted with high-quality protein, double the leucine, and enriched branched-chain amino acids, essential for optimal muscle recovery. Finally, a protein bar that works as hard as you do. So visit agrilabs.com and use the code BEP to get 20% off. That's agrilabs.com, promo code BEP.
Well, look, buddy, we wish you nothing but mad success, and I'm pretty sure you are. You guys seem very grounded, and just based on your background and, you know, obviously your faith, and look, let's be fair. We're joking around, but you've picked a beautiful woman, and she picked a very handsome man, and we're excited for what you guys are going to have in store for your family in the future. The question I have for you, my brother, listen, let's be fair here. We've been chatting for the last 6-7 months to have you come on the show. And look, you're really busy. You're all over the place. I mean, you had meetings prior to this and you have meetings right after this, right? You're planning for a wedding and you have a bunch of constituents that have needs, and you need to be able to chat about those needs or show up at places and, you know, being a legislator and arguing and debating about what laws should move forward. So knowing that, why did you want to come on a Black Executive Perspective podcast, talk about this topic?
Well, you know, first and foremost, Tony, and I appreciate you spending time, because I think so many people in media circles are just so anxious to just get the story and to get a person on to get their perspective without spending time to get to know them. And so I thought that obviously the interest in knowing Corey at his core was probably key to my being more open to wanting to join the Black Executive perspective. And look, I think that it's really important to hear from strong men and women in our community to understand what it takes to be successful. And that's only the first half of this, right? It's what it takes to remain successful and to remain grounded and to remain focused in these spaces, because we know that there are a ton of microaggressions and a ton of factors and people that will eat away at the progress that we as a community and as a diaspora are working to achieve. And so that just resonated with me more than anything. And I think that it also resonates with many of your viewers as well, because they understand that my story, their stories, that they're all interwoven and interconnected in so many ways that we're almost living the same experience, just in different industries and in different bodies. And because at the end of the day, we're all wearing the same level of melanin. And look, right, that's not for me to say that I'm race baiting, that, you know, that because I'm pro-Black, that means I'm anti anything else. It's not the case whatsoever. Right. But I do think that it is incredibly important, and I think that it's incredibly interesting that the Black experience has directly been rooted in resilience, and certainly resilience in America. And America, I believe, has drawn on that resilience because of the Black experience of the enslaved person and how we have been able to prosper and remain triumphant for generations, for the generations that have come since 1619. And so that says a lot to me. And I think that obviously drives a lot of the focus and a lot of the work that I do, because I believe that when Black Americans are successful, most successful, then all Americans, regardless of their identities as refugees and or immigrants, or just, you know, as, you know, a white person, we're all equally as successful.
Totally agree, my brother. Look, man, you seem like you're chomping at the bit. You ready to dive into this deeper, man, and talk about it? All right, buddy, let's talk about it, man. So look, you know, Your background is interesting. I mean, you've been elected in Stanford as representative, right? You came from Kansas.
Yeah.
Okay. So talk about a little bit, just give us a little bit more flavor in terms of, you know, you said I've lived here longer in Connecticut. Talk a little bit about that transition. And then I want to dive into, you know, when we're young, and maybe you did too, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a baseball player. All right. And then, you know, I wanted to go into business. Right. And, you know, I had, you know, I went in the military. Right. So I'd love to for you to dovetail from, you know, coming here and transitioning to Connecticut to coming up with the moment when you knew that public service was your calling. All right. So just talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, so my paternal family still lives in Arkansas. My maternal family lives in Kansas. And I will tell you that, not to be cliche, to steal a line that is often so associated with the state of Kansas, but there's no place like home. And I say that to say, you know, people in Kansas are fair. There's a moral compass in terms of how you treat your neighbor, your fellow human being, and humankind. I think that, you know, the values are certainly different. But I think what was really interesting for me, having grown up in Kansas, you know, coming to the East Coast, and I made my way out here because I did a fellowship with it in 2010 with the Center for Progressive Leadership, and then they would match you with a like-minded progressive movement organization, and I was matched with People for the American Way. And I will tell you that in doing all of the work that we did with them and through them, it opened up my eyes to a lot of people who came from other lived experiences with a different thought, school of thought, with different backgrounds, with different struggles, with different adversities, with different triumphs and successes. And that just made me realize that I had to get out of the bubble that was Kansas. You know, we talk about Kansas nice. Everyone is nice in Kansas. Even when they're mean, they're still nice. And so that is very much with me until I think you cross the line. And then I'm no longer Kansas nice, respectfully. But I also say that I met one of my best friends there, and he was from Stamford, Connecticut. And he said, you got to come visit Stamford. And I said, I'm never going to Connecticut. I said, first of all, my grandmothers are family members. They've talked to us about Connecticut. You don't cook up there. You only eat out at restaurants. People don't go to church. And, you know, everyone's on their phone. Everyone is a workaholic. I don't want to go up there. And he's like, you just kind of have to come up and visit. Well, I came up and I was proven wrong. And I was also recognizing and realizing as a coming of age, as a young person who was starting to gain his own thoughts and theories and understanding about the world that we lived in, Connecticut was way more my speed because there was a like-mindedness in terms of where I fell on the spectrum on certain issues and where many of the people in the state fell on the spectrum. And so it felt almost kinetic in terms of the energy that it was giving off that I would, you know, find myself and make myself here at home. Although I think the thing that I miss most about Kansas and certainly Arkansas is the simplicity of life. And Connecticut certainly is simple, but, you know, I grew up riding horses and going down to our family farm and playing Scrabble and going to church 2 to 3 times a week. Like that's where we placed a lot of our focus. And so I miss that, but I also think that's just adulting, right? Because I am on the trajectory of my career of trying to grind now. But I think that I'm grounded in that idea that that's never too far away. So for me growing up, I think most of my family members probably expected that I would become a pastor. And I think as I got older, you know, and moved to the East Coast, I grew up in a very strict Pentecostal upbringing. So we didn't believe in drinking. We didn't believe in cursing. We didn't believe in a lot of the things that, you know, I might socially partake in, not the cursing in case my grandmother's watching this, but certainly,
well, at least not on camera, right?
Yeah, I would hope, but certainly the drinking, you know, or I grew up in a family where we thought those who were representing us in certain industries and in certain areas of life, that they had to be above par, that they had to live above the fray. And I just did not believe that I was going to be able to live above the fray to then go into a pulpit every Sunday to preach to people of how they need to be doing better when I knew that I was not that shining example at all. But there was a clear expectation from my great grandparents, from my grandmother, that I had to give back, that I had to commit myself to some form of service in some way, whether it was the military, you know, doing nonprofit work, foundation work, whatever it was, I had to give back. And so politics, aside from being a pip with Gladys Knight, politics was just the natural fit. And I believe that by just the sheer example of just walking into this space and getting elected, that was clearly on God's bingo card.
You know, my friend, well, number one, thanks for sharing that. Let me just back up a little bit because you said a couple of things and I want to dive a little bit deeper in them before we move forward. And you said, hey, I didn't want to come to Connecticut because I thought this, I thought that, I thought this, right? And then I came and said, oh, it ain't that way, right? And unfortunately, especially in our country, and I think maybe all human beings do this, but especially now, we get caught up in thinking that certain people, certain area are in boxes, all right? And because where we grow up, where our environment is, and then we hear about certain areas, or we may see things on television or hear certain media things, we think that, you know, I want to go there. Those people are like this and those people are like that, or this place is like that and this and that. And then when we tend to get out and go to those places, we tend to find out that's not the case. Right. Okay. That, guess what? There's churches here. There's people in faith and all the things that you basically chatted about that you thought, you know, this and that, you came and said, oh my God, this is more my speed than anything, right?
I think to that point also, it taught me, by living here, it taught me to be way more tolerant in understanding the plight of other people who were marginalized.
That's my point I wanted to get to, right?
If you like what you hear and want to join us on this journey of making uncomfortable conversations comfortable, please subscribe to a Black Executive Perspective podcast on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hit subscribe now to stay connected for more episodes that challenge, inspire, and lead the change.
Is that a lot of times people tend to think that this group or that group, they got this or they're not doing this based on erroneous information, or just based on they're sitting in a place and they've never had those lived experiences. They've never been across county lines or state lines. But they know the world. Okay. Yeah. And this is where our ignorance gets in the way of really, you know, sitting back and trying and understanding that face to face communication and experience is really more of an education versus information that may come that could be erroneous, right? And so I love, I'm glad we kicked it off there because that's really key. And more importantly for you, and I love the fact, you know, your family and service and faith, and you got to give back. And then, you know, I think you're a little too hard on yourself. I think you still could have been a pastor, all right? Because there's no perfect person, just to be fair, all right? But all that being said, those things, how we grow up, regardless of what industry or whatever, they set us up for us to be able to grow in those areas because we have a great foundation. And because you had a great family foundation, going into service, going into public service, it was already set up because at the end of the day, your grandmother and her grandmother and this and that taught you and your siblings and the whole nine yards, it's about giving. It's about making, helping other people regardless. So let's do this, my brother. We kicked off, you're 34. We went through, you were a vice admiral. You were a lord of the lords. You know what I'm saying? The only thing I didn't hear here is they gave you land and title. All right. But as being a young legislator, right, let's talk about some of the things that you're diving into that typically those roles wouldn't go to. It would go more to veteran legislators, right? Yeah. So talk a little bit about how you got into that. And then more importantly, how Because you're not, how should I say, jaded, or you've been doing this a long period of time, or they just do this, they just do that, that you're looking at it from a different lens and maybe a different energy versus, and I don't want to put people in boxes either, but talk a little bit about how you got involved at a young age and the differences that you're making while you're there.
Well, you know, and people would just probably assume that I've been a raging liberal my entire life. I actually grew up in a pretty
conservative area, right?
Right. A conservative family. Yeah. For the most part, I think 90% of them have now become moderate Democrats over the last couple of decades. But I will tell you, my great-grandfather was the reason why I took such an interest in politics. And I can pinpoint the day and the time when it happened. It was President's Day weekend. I had to be about 5 or 6 years old. And they had all of the presidents in the newspaper in order. And he was teaching me all of the presidents and talking to me about the presidents and policies and little historical facts. And then I was a very inquisitive child. So then I started asking more questions, you know, deeper and deeper and deeper around things, to the point that I just became, you know, a geek around government and around policy and around people and around history. And I think right now for me, politically, my thing is that I commend those who have been successful and who have been able to rise to a level of success that has afforded them a more affluent life. I'm worried about those in the middle who are making, you know, a decent living and who are just trying to do what's right to get ahead but cannot get ahead. And I'm really focused on the most vulnerable, those who have no voices for themselves, those who cannot get jobs, who are unhoused, who are going to bed hungry at night. You know, I think that we have to be worried about every single last one of those folks in each group and demographic. And I will tell you, you know, there's a famous speech that Mario Cuomo gave in 1984 at the Democratic National Convention, where he says, for the teacher in Little Rock, Arkansas, who makes very little money, her concerns are our concerns. For the labor movement worker in San Francisco, his concerns are our concerns. For the mining person in West Virginia, same thing. And that's what I think about. It's not just about Stanford. It's the concerns of every person in our state, no matter what they believe, no matter what party affiliation they may hold, no matter their race or gender. I seriously am concerned for all of them. And that's why I try to take policy that perhaps people may deem as unpopular or controversial, and try for us to find common ground in those areas, in those spaces.
Corey, real quick, when you say policy that people may find controversial, give me some examples of what type of policies are those.
Well, you talk about student loans, and I certainly feel that way. I think the same about poverty. You know, there is a real war around poverty. Those are all of the things that at least two of the things that I could think of. Education, certainly higher education. Housing and the advancement of young people, young professionals. So all the things that you would think should just be no brainers.
I mean, when you're saying them, I'm just sitting here laughing. How is that controversial? I mean, finish your thought. But,
I think to that point, Tony, you know, it's controversial because we have to take very hard lines along party lines. And it shouldn't be that's how we handle such tough and important issues. But it is how we've had to operate under various forms of government. Certainly here, we're more bipartisan in the state of Connecticut on many issues. But that does not mean that it will always last, and that we have to be vigilant in being able to say we're separating ourselves from the stance and focusing on the issue. If we can find compromise on some of those things, I think that we could be in a much better position.
You know, when you talked about poverty and you talked about education, right? And I believe there was a new legislation that was put out called the New Care for Kids Act, right? And the cap is at what, 7% of income impacting working families. So how
who makes under $100,000 has free child care.
So talk a little bit about that as part of, you know, the things that you believe and the things that you're working on to try to help these people.
Well, having had worked in the child care space professionally, and now working on this issue in the legislature, it is, you know, apparent to me and incredibly critical to me that this is the greatest equalizer in terms of socioeconomic status, in terms of educational status, in terms of racial disparities and gender disparities for young children. This is the great equalizer, that if we afford every family and every young child to a quality and comprehensive early childhood education, then they will be better off. And we can actually spend less money on grades, you know, K through 12, because we've put more investment in pre-K. And I, look, have worked on this issue with many colleagues here who care just as passionately and equally about this subject as I do. And this bill was big. It was really important for us to start this endowment and to start this this trust fund of sorts so that we can better pay teachers. Think about this. I mean, the vast majority of child care providers in our state, about 90% of them are women. Another 85% of them are women of color. Once you draw down that 90%, on average, they're making about $30,000 a year. So you're going to school, and in our state, it's mandated that you have to have a degree in early childhood education in order to be a provider. So you're literally going into debt for a $30,000 a year career and job. And for us not to step in to help offset that cost and to help bring more greater awareness around parity in terms of salary for a lot of these folks, you know, shame on us for not doing this sooner. And not just as a state, but also as a nation. And so I think that this is going to open the door for this to be an example and blueprint for a lot of other states, but it's certainly going to change how we do things here in Connecticut.
Was this a bipartisan a thing that people on both sides of the aisle came together?
You know, it was. I think a lot of people were open to the idea of solving child care.
So that means no.
I don't think everyone was on board with how much we expend for child care. But, you know, certainly it did earn a lot of bipartisan praise and support. But again, it's how we get to that point when the votes are finally cast. And sometimes we do make great strides on a number of issues, and other times we don't.
You passed it, it got through, and this and that. Yeah. But just to dive in a little bit deeper in terms of some of the inner workings. So was the pushback because this was being more money was being spent from a budgetary standpoint versus I believe in it, but we ain't got the money. Was it more of that?
I think it's both. It's a little bit of both. It's not out of the question that those two thoughts can be mutually exclusive of one another.
Right.
I think that happens. I'm sure that was the same thing, the same thought process when we focused on Medicaid and Medicare in the late 60s. I'm sure it was the same thing when we focused on Social Security. I'm sure it's the same things when we focused on regulating the banks. All of the great policies that have shaped generations and shaped narratives and shaped, obviously, the outcomes for many families.
The outcomes, right.
You know, those are the arguments and discussions that I'm sure were had amongst other policy leaders like myself.
Well, I we're talking from a political standpoint, but these are the conversations that husbands and wives have in terms of deciding where they're going to spend their money, right? It's a good idea, but we ain't got the money.
I just don't talk about it in my household, because if I don't talk about spending money, I won't give any ideas that we need to spend money. So I just leave that completely alone altogether.
Well, I'll tell you this quick little story, buddy, why this hits home. So, you know, my daughter, we just took our daughter to college over the weekend. She's at Fordham in New York City.
Yeah.
And we have another daughter who'll be a high school senior this year. And when they were in, so they're a year and 6 days apart. Okay. Yeah. And so when they were 3 and 2, okay, my wife, I've worked in New York City for 25 years, commuting from Connecticut. My wife stayed at home because she worked for ESPN for years. But then once we had kids, she wanted to stay home, right? And which I was all for. But, and I want to say but, however, she wanted them to go to this daycare, okay? That was, and it was $30,000, okay? And I'm like, we can't afford that, right? And so we got into a big fight, right? And at the end of the day, and I'm just being, and look, let me just say this. When we were going through it, I was just like, because I'm going by my experience, right? I grew up, I didn't go to no type of daycare like that. I was like, plus, I never met any person in my life that said, you know what, man? I would have really made it in life had I gone to a better daycare?
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me finish my thought. Then I want to hear you, okay? But guess what? I lost, okay? And we put my daughter, and then we had to put my other daughter through it, right? So that's two. And then I was able to subsidize it through work and all stuff, benefits I didn't even know I had, to be fair, right? However, it was the best thing, okay?
Yeah.
Because they got a tremendous head start, okay? They were net, going back to those fights about it's a great idea, but I don't know if we got the money. But then we end up doing it. Same thing you talked about with Social Security and Medicare, all these things. And then the end result is like, hey, it worked out. So I just wanted to give you that type of lived experience when it comes to that.
Well, and that's the lived experience of so many people, exactly what you just shared. But also, the cost is to send one child to early childhood education program in this day and age in our state is literally the equivalent of sending them to a public state institution and university.
Think about that. That's
so you're
my
literally
point.
Paying it twice. However, I also think that the outcomes for young children of color, especially young boys, for them to have that attention earlier on, it helps for them to better regulate their emotions. It helps for them to be stronger readers. And I mean, literally 90% of the brain development happens from birth to the age of five. And as a state, up until, you know, this bill starts to kick in, as a state, we've only spent about 12 and a half. We've spent less than $500 million on 90% of the brain and more than $12.5 billion on 10% of the brain between kindergarten and 12th grade. And so it's just lopsided in terms of the inequities and how we are actually allocating that money. And this is going to make a bigger difference for a lot of young people of color and a lot of young people who come from more restrained socioeconomic backgrounds. This is going to make it better for them. But then you think about that generationally, it's also going to encourage more people. And I often say this, Tony, if this was a male-dominated field, we would not have to be fighting to have women paid more than $30,000 a year.
That's a fair point. But that's an excellent point, bro.
Because this does have a dominance amongst women, it is hard for us to have to make that case, but it is the truth.
Right. You know, one of the other things, buddy, is that, you know, you talked about controversial policies, student loans.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, I'm sitting here looking in the screen, and then we got the founding father of the Connecticut Student Loan Reimbursement Program. So talk a little bit about that program. Why did you get involved? Why did you start it? And the benefit that people are going to get out of it?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, this program was a bipartisan effort. We got Republicans to sign on to it and support it. It is now being talked about in states like Kansas and Minnesota and California. Maryland actually just enacted and passed the same bill and the same program in their state as well. And I will tell you this, you know, the thing that is the reason why it's such an important issue is because it is the ultimate determining factor for how successful you will be in life after you have graduated. The reason why I say that is because it determines everything from how much you'll pay for a car down to how much you'll pay in car insurance because of the debt to income ratio that a borrower might hold.
Correct.
It also determines your credit score. It determines the lifetime dividends that you'll get back on your income and on your salary. But what we've also seen here in the state of Connecticut is that at the time when I took up this crusade, Connecticut had about $18.5 billion in student loan debt across the and we were the fourth highest in the country in terms of how much debt we held. Since then, I mean, this year alone, we've seen that increase about $2.5 billion. So as a state, we hold across 500,000 borrowers, $20 billion in student loan debt. Could you imagine if we infused $20 billion back into our state economy because debt, people who are getting that money back, who are saving that money.
They'll spend money back into buy houses.
Right.
They'll do all type of stuff, right?
It's economic empowerment. People can start businesses. People could go back, get another degree. People could buy a home. What's also really interesting to me about that is that 10 years after people of color have taken out a student loan, they have not paid off more than 10% of that loan. But 10 years after taking out that loan, their white counterparts, especially white men, have paid off nearly 90% of that loan. The interest is what's killing and holding people back. And I hear people say, well, you know, I know someone who's making $200,000 a year. They should be able to pay that loan back. But if you think about, you know, rent and rents being
buddy, flat out,
transportation, food,
right. And those costs are net costs.
That's right. Those are net costs. And people don't realize that your student loan is literally, some people are paying close to $1,300 a month in student loan repayment. The other reason why it's so important now is that since the current administration has gotten back into office, the Department of Education has not notified people as to their loans coming due again and them needing to repay their loans. And so what has happened is that you've seen a lot of people wake up one morning and their credit scores have dropped nearly 200 to 300 points on average because the federal government has reported their loans as being overdue.
Default. Past due. Oh, wow.
So now you've just completely any you know progress that you've made on a personal from a personal level to grow financially, you've completely wiped that out just because of these decisions that have been made from the federal government.
You know, my friend, I want to, you look, you've done a lot of great things, right? And again, I don't see, and obviously, you know, child care, student loan debt, affordable housing, I don't see how those are controversial. And I get it from a cost standpoint. I get it. But everybody should have an affordable place to live. Yep. Everybody should be able to go to higher learning and not mortgage their life, right? Yep. I mean, we can go on and on and on, right? And you're championing, you're doing those things, right? Here's the thing I want to dive into, right? We live in a capitalist society. All right. And when you live in a capitalist society, it's every man for himself, because that's the mindset. Right. And to your point, you make 200 grand, you should be able to do this or this, that. And where I struggle a little bit is that there's a lot of poor people. All right. That are not just black or people of color, white. And they kind of dive into this mindset. But these same programs are saving their lives.
Yeah.
Okay? And without those programs, they would be under. And they already ain't above water, to be fair. Right. Okay? Can you dive into that a little bit? Because I just don't understand it. And look, let's be clear here. I just want to be clear. I believe that obviously, everybody's got to bring it every day. All right. At the end of the day, I believe that as long as you work abled and you got right mind and this and that, you got to bring it. Right. But I'm also not dumb enough to know that every person is not going to be a lawyer or a doctor or this and that. People are going to find jobs and stuff based on where they live, based on the economic. Some of them not going to. Everybody's not meant to go to school. There's a million things that dive into. Some people are taking care of parents or a mother died or a brother's disabled or whatever. There's a million things. Right. But I just don't understand the minds. I understand our economic system. I don't understand how millions of people don't understand that the things that that are helping them survive on a daily basis, they push against all the time. Can you talk a little bit about that, man?
Well, I don't know if we have enough time, Tony, to dive into that. And I'm also not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but I will tell you that part of the challenge is because they're buying into a narrative that because other people who are marginalized and have less than they do. You know, Lyndon Johnson had a saying, you could tell the poorest white Southerner that you can convince them that they are better than the most educated black person. And they will tell you that they will vote against their own ideals.
Flat out, buddy. Flat out.
Because they just have to make sure that they are better than the other than someone of a different race and different belonging. And so I say all of this to say that I think it's just the times that we're in politically. What many people from both parties believe right now, they may not have believed 20 years ago.
That's fair.
But I will also say that It's like I'm taking away from you. Like I'm getting a handout.
That's the mindset. Exactly.
Let me tell you something. College is 260% more expensive today than it was 30 or 40 years ago, and continues to grow in terms of how much it costs to send someone, a young person, to school. In addition to that, I'll go one step further. You think about this in terms of, well, I don't understand why you get help and I don't. We have bailed out the banks. We have bailed out airlines.
Thank you, buddy. I mean, you're kidding me.
Everyone.
The auto industry came with their hats in their hand.
But when we talk about bailing out future generations in this country, when we talk about bailing out Main Street, that becomes too controversial. And let me tell you something else, Tony. In the state of Connecticut, you want to know the age demographic of who holds the highest student loan debt? I want you to guess.
White people?
Age-wise, it's actually 50 to 70-year-old people. I have people in my district who are 70-plus years old still holding $60,000 in student loan debt.
That's insane.
And they'll never pay it off.
But we're arguing and talking about, they took it. They should pay it off. Right. They should do this. They should do that. Right. And again, a lot of these people never went to college, to be fair.
Right. Right.
All right. So I don't understand it, my man. But here's the other thing I don't understand. Let's be fair here, too. And when we started this, our show today, you had already had a tough day. Okay. And look, we all in every type of industry, we have tough days, right? But to be fair, though, being a public servant, there's a lot of negativity that you deal with. Okay. When I worked in corporate America, I dealt with clients and I dealt with internal situations, right? And those were my two worlds. Then when I went home, I was at the grocery store. Somebody didn't walk up to me and says, I don't like your stance on what you did at work, right? I don't have that, right? However, your world is totally different. Because not only you're navigating internal in the legislature, which we all do from a work standpoint, relationships, debates, the whole nine yards, right? But then you're also dealing with the outside forces of public perception or in misinformation, and then that causes an angst as well.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's something that most people don't deal with. And as being a young, highly educated individual, you could go and do anything anywhere else. All right. So why do you still stay within this based on all the vitriol, all the negativity and stuff that's being thrown at you at every angle?
That's a deep question. And now I feel like I'm in a therapy session, Tony. that's not what I signed up for. And I'm kind of upset now. You know, I think I do it because I stick with it because there are too many people who I'm not, you know, there's so many like-minded colleagues of mine. And I'll say on both sides of the aisle, but I probably agree more with those who I share an allegiance to party to, who believe that if we can just get through this year, this session, we can make some progress. And it is hard being in politics and having to deal with the naysayers and the hate and the misinformation because people don't know what it's actually like.
You know what? Can you hold that thought real fast? Because I don't think more people understand what you deal with when you're trying to help your fellow human being. I want to play something really quickly and I want to get your thoughts.
Today, more than 30 state and local leaders met to defend State Representative Corey Paris, who said he got death threats after he made a social media post warning people about ICE agents in his district.
It all started last week when State Representative Corey Paris put out a message on Instagram telling people to stay vigilant and safe after reports of ICE being in his district. He also encouraged people to share any ICE activity with local advocacy groups.
Every one of these government officials who stand today in the public light is potentially a target of these same kinds of right-wing, extremist, threats.
Senator Richard Blumenthal joined other leaders to defend Paris's actions on social media. They say he did nothing illegal or wrong by telling people to watch out for ICE and say ICE was in the wrong for reposting Paris's post, saying Paris is helping illegal immigrants evade arrest and impeding ICE. That post has been viewed hundreds of thousands of times.
It is a life-altering event. It makes you look at the work that you're doing in a way that you've never looked at it before.
And these kind of threats that drive noble people out of this profession, as many of us are trying to bring back the integrity that this profession deserves and that the people who elect us deserve.
On behalf of the Senate Republican Caucus, Senator Stephen Harding put out this message of support for Paris. More than 30 leaders stood side by side, agreeing on one thing. Hate and death threats have no place in Connecticut, no matter where you stand on the issue of ICE.
So, buddy, let's just be clear here, okay? This is what I'm talking about. And to be fair, everybody, your legislative partner stood up for you, right? Across the aisle. Everybody had your back, which was beautiful. There was no, as far as I know, there was no blah, blah. Everybody, no, this does not happen. But let's be fair, though. You know, how did that make you feel? Okay.
Yeah.
How did you, you know, because that, I'll be honest with you, that's tough. That's tough.
Yeah. Well, it's also tough because my family's involved.
Exactly.
And my family didn't sign up to run for office. They have their own lives, but it is the phone calls, the calls for us to be lynched, for me to be lynched, to be executed, to come after my family. That, you know, those are not things that go through your mind when you just simply want to make a difference for people and when you have a heart for people. And I have that heart for people, and that's all I wanted to do. I will tell you that I've had... As many colleagues that came out to support, there are colleagues on the other side who retweeted the post and said that I quite obviously hate America. I will also say that the federal government, the Department of Justice and, ICE, the ICE agency retweeted that same post, which has now been seen over 2 million times.
Insane.
That has drawn racial hate, has drawn death threats. And that's not a lie. That's a fact.
That's a fact. Those are facts.
That I'm making this up. No, that is a fact. But when the federal agency that's under the jurisdiction of the President of the United States reposts that, and then they tag the Department of Justice saying that I need to be jailed, and then in print newspapers they say he was wrong and he put our agents at risk. People are going to continue to believe that. We're talking about people's lives on the line here. Not just mine, but families who chose to come to this country for a better life, who chose to come to this country for more opportunities, who are doing jobs in certain industries and fields that most Americans would never want to do, and who are friends and our neighbors. But above all else, I didn't have a choice to come to this country. My ancestors didn't have a choice to come to this country. We were brought to this country on ships, in chains, and we built this country.
Built it.
But because of that resilience, these folks live in fear every day of their lives. And from some point, we also know what that fear looks like. And it's not fair for them to wonder whether or not they send their kids off to school in the morning. Will their kids return home or will they return home to their kids?
Look, my brother, I got to say this. I love you a lot. Okay. And I say that not because we're recording something, because I feel for you. And for what you're doing, and like you said, your family didn't sign up for this,
right?
Okay, and it's easy for people to throw, you know, venom,
yeah,
and all different type of things when it doesn't affect them,
right?
Okay, and so I got mad respect for you, and thank for you to still show up and bring it every day. And this is what, and you just got finished saying something. I want to dive in a little deeper too. This is some of the things that people don't understand what African American or people of color go through. Okay.
Right.
Because these things don't affect them. And we still got to go to work. We still got to take our kids to school. We still got to kiss our wives. We still got to show up, and perform on a high level with this extra baggage.
It tears at you emotionally.
Exactly.
Mentally, physically. And it's terrible. It's terrible. I don't think anyone should deal
nobody.
With from either side, right? And I have colleagues on the Republican side who were upset because there was a press conference held in support. But, you know, if anyone from the Republican side had been threatened, there was not a press conference. Look, I didn't attend that press conference out of a sheer abundance of just trying to be there for my family during that point in time. But we have a job to do. Through thick and thin, we have a job to do. And there are people like John Lewis and Medgar Evers and Dr. King and both of the Kennedy.
Keep going, buddy. Exactly.
Fannie Lou Hamer. It does not matter. They've all gone through way worse than that. And that's saying a lot because this is pretty bad. But I owe it until I'm you know, no longer serving. I owe it to those that had elected me, that were able to vote for me, that are not able to vote for me yet, or that did not vote for me at all, to continue to serve them with honor and distinction.
Buddy, if anybody ever questions your character, okay, all they got to do is look at you. Because at the end of the day, what you show, this is what happens, is that a true person's character is revealed through adversity.
Yeah.
Okay? And at the end of the day, you didn't crawl up in a hole. You stood out, and you're still taking care of your constituents, even though your family was threatened by death.
Right.
So if anybody wants to question Corey Parris's character or where he stands as a human being or how entrenched he is into public service, they don't know what they're talking about. Have every reason to run and I'm done with this or blah, 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 blah. But you know what you did? You got up the next day and showed up. So nothing but mad respect, my brother. Okay. Yeah. And when we talk about leadership.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what leadership is about, man. And flat out.
I agree.
So final thoughts, my brother. What do you want to leave our everyone here on a Black Executive Perspective podcast?
I think everybody needs to know that they're all Black executives in their own way. And we need for our folks and our allies who are in support of our success to rise up and take on that mantle as best as they possibly can. Everyone's perspective, especially from the perspective of a Black person, has a lot of thought and truth into how we should operate as a country. And I will encourage everyone that's listening and that watches this broadcast to literally think about how we can leave this country in a more just position, in a more just place than what we found it. And because I know that that's why I'm doing the work that I'm doing, is it's for a more just society, not just to have justice. And so with that said, you know, I hope that we can continue to really live up to the ideals that I think that we all have for the republic that we live in, that we do create a better country, and that we don't just look at certain spots in our country to say, this is what we had hoped to be, and then look at where we are today and say, this is who we actually are and have always been. I want us to be better than that, but I can't do that alone. Tony, you can't do that alone. But as we start to voice those opinions and start to question the wrongdoings of the world, I think we get a little bit closer to being a better place.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you this. If we had more people like yourself, we definitely would be on our way to a better place. So I want to thank you for investing the time on a busy day for you to come on a Black Executive Perspective podcast to share your perspective. And more importantly, my brother, I love you a lot. So let me ask you this question. How can a Black Executive Perspective podcast help you, my brother?
Well, we tell people all the time, you know, follow all of the work that we're doing, both on Facebook, State Representative Corey P. Parris or Corey P. Parris for Connecticut, or follow us on Instagram, Rep. Corey Parris or Corey Parris for CT. You know, follow what we're doing, get involved, but above all else, challenge yourself to do a little bit more than what you're doing today, because it will change somebody's tomorrow.
Well, thank you, my brother. And we're going to put that up on our website and on the show. So definitely, we had a great time chatting with Representative Corey Parris today, learning his background, learning his conviction, and more importantly, seeing what character really is. So again, we want to thank you for appearing on the Black Executive Perspective podcast, my brother.
Thank you, Tony.
So now I think it's time for
Tony's Tidbit.
And the tidbit today: real leadership isn't about age or title. It's about the courage to turn vision into action and service into change. You don't need decades in office to make an impact. Only conviction, compassion, and the will to fight for those unheard. And I'm going to tell you flat out, my boy, he encompasses all of that. All right, my boy, Corey Paris. So, I mean, he spoke to all of this. So, again, I want to thank him. But more importantly, I want to make sure that you check out the next Need to Know by Dr. Nasinga Burton here on the Black Executive Perspective Podcast. Dr. Burton dives into the most timely and crucial topics that you don't have time to check out. And these topics shape our community and world. Tune in to gain more insight and deepen your understanding of the issues that matter. You don't want to miss it here every Thursday on the Black Executive Perspective Podcast. And we don't want you to miss our next Pull Up Speak Up, where our roundtable dives into the most provocative topics, unfiltered voices, sharp perspectives, real talk, a call to action. You got to check it out, because this is where you have people get together and talk about these topics. Check out Pull Up Speak Up here on the Black Executive Perspective Podcast. So, for people who follow us, they know what our call to action is. This is your first time watching or listening to Black Executive Perspective Podcast. Our goal is to eliminate all forms of discrimination. And to do that, we ask everyone to incorporate our acronym called LESS. L-E-S-S. The L stands for learn. We want everyone to learn about racial and cultural nuances that you're not familiar with. This is going to help enlighten you. And then after you learn, you have the letter E. That stands for empathy. Now, since you've learned, now since you've become more enlightened, now you can be more empathetic to people that you didn't know, because you can put yourself in their shoes. And the first S stands for share. Now you want to share what you learned to your friends and family. Just like when you see a good movie, you're like, man, you gotta check out this movie. You want to share that. And then the final S stands for stop. We want you. You want to stop discrimination as it walks in your path. So if Aunt Jenny or Uncle Joe says something that's inappropriate at the Sunday dinner table, you say, Aunt Jenny, Uncle Joe, we don't believe that. We don't say that. And you stop it right there. So if everyone can incorporate less, L-E-S-S, we'll build a more fair, more understanding world. And we all will see the change that we want to see, because less will become more. Don't forget to check out the Black Executive Perspective Podcast here on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Come to our website, sign up for our newsletter, and don't forget to follow us on all our social channels of LinkedIn, X, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. At a Black Exec. For our fabulous guest, State Representative Corey Paris, I'm Tony Tidbit. We talked about it. We learned about it. We laughed about it. We still gonna strive and thrive about it. We gonna pray about it. We love you. And guess what? We're out.
A Black Executive Perspective.